Hey, what's up, you guys? I'm Andrea.
And I'm Haley.
And you're listening to Inhuman, a true crime podcast. Okay, guys, so today's case, it's a wild one. It's a crazy one. It's a highly requested one. It's a one of the big cases that other podcasts cover that we don't typically cover, but I wanted to dive into it nonetheless. Yep. So I'm actually going to be covering Edmund Kemper, the co-ed killer, a.k.a. the co-ed butcher, a.k.a. the gentle giant.
Oh, gosh. I am so excited. I already told Andrea this, but I'll tell you guys. I feel like I haven't listened or read or watched anything about him in such a long time that I honestly, other than knowing like he's a serial killer, I can't remember a lot about him. So I'm like really excited for you to, I mean, obviously not because it's horrific, but you know, I'm excited to get into the story because I really don't either. I'm sure at some point I heard all of the details, but I don't remember them. So I'm pumped for this.
Well, so the reason I kind of decided to cover him, mainly because, you know, when people find out that I'm interested in true crime or that I have a true crime podcast, I inevitably get asked, who's your favorite serial killer? Which I don't really like that terminology because it's not favorite, because why would you have a favorite serial killer?
Yeah.
I think more so what they mean is like, which serial killer do you find the most interesting?
Yeah.
Or in this case, like fascinating?
Yeah.
And the reason that I do find him so fascinating is because in my opinion, he doesn't fit the textbook definition of like a psychopath, a narcissist, a sociopath, even though he is kind of all of those things. Like, he also had guilt, and he turned himself in for his crimes, and he was in a constant internal war with himself over, you know, committing these horrific acts.
Yeah.
That to me is just very intriguing because it's like almost like he had two people in his brain, you know, he had like the good, like sweet, gentle, kind, you know, polite Ed, and then you had this like horrible,
horrific serial killer.
Yeah, monster.
Oh my.
And not only that, but he was also a borderline genius. He had an IQ of 145, which, if you don't know, 180 is considered a genius.
Oh wow.
He was like right there.
It makes me so sad. I feel like that happens so often that serial killers or just killers in general have really high IQs, and it's just so heartbreaking because it's like, had they, I mean, obviously it's not all nurture, but had they been in the proper environment growing up, they could have been like very successful and could have cured diseases and stuff because they're smart. But unfortunately, it just goes the other way.
And I think in Ed's case, a lot of it was nurture. I think his environment, the way he was raised, his parents, I think that had a lot to do with it.
Okay.
Obviously, we're not going to, you know, blame them entirely because we don't know what went on behind closed doors aside from, you know, what he's told.
Right,
and what
his account.
His sisters his and things. Account. Yeah, but okay, so without further ado, I'm just going to, and let me tell you, I researched this case like I have never researched a case before because I thought I knew a lot about him. So I kind of like already had an idea of like what I was going to cover and how I was going to cover it. But I got so engrossed with the research. I was watching documentaries. I was reading articles. I was reading like excerpts from different books. I really went in.
I'm so excited. Okay.
So let's get into it. So Edmund Emil Kemper III was born on December 18th, 1948 in Burbank, California.
Of course he's born in Burbank. Get out of California.
I don't know anything about Burbank. Okay, I was going to say, you're a California girl, so you know more about that area. And
yeah, I mean, there's nothing bad about it, but I'm just like, go away. We don't want you here.
His parents, Clarnell Elizabeth Kemper and Edmund Emil Kemper Jr., had three children together. Ed was the middle and only boy. His sister Susan was 5 years older than him, and his sister Alan was 2 years younger.
Okay.
From birth, Ed was big. He weighed in at a whopping 13 pounds.
Oh my God.
Poor his mother, because that is ginormous. 13. I mean, that's like double the size of even, well, the twins were 7-ish pounds.
Okay.
So that's almost, okay. Double, yeah, but yeah. The average baby, I guess, is like 6 to 8 pounds normally.
Wow.
By the age of 4, he was already significantly taller than all of his peers. Ed's parents had a rocky marriage. Clarnell often complained about the skimpy earnings from Edmund Jr.'s job, and it made him so frustrated that he once reportedly said, quote, "Suicide missions in wartime and the atomic bomb testings were nothing compared to living with her."
Oh my gosh.
And this was because Ed's father had enlisted in the army. He was on June 21st, 1939, and he was a World War II veteran. After being discharged from the army, he went on to test atomic bombs in the Pacific Proving Grounds before returning to California, where he then worked as an electrician.
Oh, okay.
So he's saying, like, all of that is better than his wife.
That's okay.
So he was very closed off from his children emotionally, and he did not hold them much when they were young. Around the age of 2, those close to Ed started noticing a change in his behavior. In later interviews, his sister Alan believes that part of the reason that he started to change was because of the neglect from his father.
Okay.
As a child, Ed would often want to play bizarre games. He'd ask his sisters to play gas chamber and electric chair.
That's all right.
During these games, Ed's younger sister Alan would tie him up and flip an imaginary switch. Ed would then fall over and writhe on the floor, pretending that he was being executed by gas or electricity.
Wow. I don't even know what else to say to that.
Yeah, it's telling for sure, because that's not, in my mind, that's not normal child behavior.
Yeah.
Other disturbing behaviors by Ed during his childhood was that he would often cut off the hands and heads of his sister's dolls.
That's so sad.
I know, it's, yeah. This next part, I do want to give a trigger warning because it involves extreme animal cruelty.
Oh no. Okay, I'm gonna just like go away for a minute and I'll be right back.
Yeah, you might want to, because it's pretty horrific. When Ed was 10 years old, he buried the family cat alive, dug it back out after it had died, decapitated it, and mounted its head on a spike.
What the fuck?
Then, when he was 13, he killed another family cat after he thought that the cat was showing his sister more affection and attention than him.
Oh my gosh.
He cut the cat into multiple pieces, and he kept those pieces in his closet until his mother found them.
Wow. So what did his mother think when she found them?
She was horrified. She was disturbed. She already had suspicions that something was awry with Ed, but she did not handle it in the best way, in my opinion.
Okay.
You know, instead of getting him, like, therapy, which obviously it was, what, the 60s? So a lot of that stuff wasn't available to most people, or if it was available, it was like very taboo. And
yeah, I was going to say it wasn't as well known and things like that.
So if you're unaware, cruelty to animals is part of the McDonald trifecta.
Yep.
This was an idea that was proposed in 1963 by psychiatrist John McDonald. He hypothesized that 3 behaviors, which were cruelty to animals, fire starting, and persistent bedwetting past the age of 5, could foretell whether a child would grow up and commit violent criminal offenses, possibly even serial murder in adulthood. This theory later faded out to some degree, since all serial killers did not exhibit these 3 behaviors, but often at least one of these behaviors coupled with childhood trauma would end up being a commonality with most serial killers.
Yeah.
So Ed actually exhibited the cruelty to animals and the bedwetting. So he did have 2 out of the 3, along with the childhood trauma. As a child, Ed also experienced a couple of near-death experiences. One of those was when his sister Susan, so his older sister, tried to push him in front of a train.
Oh my gosh.
And then another time, she pushed him into the deep end of a pool where he almost drowned.
Oh my gosh.
What's
going on with this family?
I'm like, wait a second.
Oh my gosh.
This is not normal behavior.
And also, I want to say, because I feel like we're going to have people commenting on this, people have said that the McDonald trifecta, like, isn't a perfect predictor. And, like, in recent years, I feel like some people have kind of done more research on it and said that. So we are aware of that. But it also is clearly connected to serial killers, because several serial killers exhibit at least one or two of the three. So I just want to say that, because I feel like some people might come and say, well, it's outdated, but just we do know that. But also there's evidence to show that it is true. So, you know, there's a lot of research on it. And that's not what this story is about. Andrea's just sharing some of the things that he exhibited that could have indicated that he would have become a killer.
Exactly. And during that time, that was very prevalent. That theory was very prevalent. And like, you know, it has faded out to some degree. And, you know, there's a lot of other factors and things like that. But I thought it was worth mentioning because it's still very fascinating. And I think that it is definitely something to look at.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, clearly there's a connection between those markers and serial killers.
Absolutely. In 1957, Ed's parents sadly divorced. Well, sadly for them, but probably not for the parents. And his mother and all three children moved to Helena, Montana. This devastated Ed. He had, you know, as he gotten older, he had grown close with his father, but he despised his mother.
That's so sad.
Being taken away from his dad and being forced to live with his mother in another state was really hard on him. The relationship between Edmund and his mother was difficult, to say the least. Clarnell was an alcoholic, and she was very critical of Ed and would constantly berate him. She would blame him for all of her problems. She forced him to live in the basement away from his sisters, whom she feared he might hurt in some way.
Wow.
In one source, I actually read that she would lock him in the basement. So not only did he just live in the basement, like she would, according to this one source, he would be locked in there.
That's so sad.
I know. And during one of the documentaries I watched, which I will link it in the show notes and stuff for the sources, but his sister said that the basement was basically an unfinished basement. And in order to turn the light on, you had to go down the dark steps into the dark basement to turn it on. And he was only like 9 and 10 years old.
Oh my gosh. I hate that.
It's hard not to have like sympathy for him, you know?
Yeah. For the young him.
Yeah, for the young him, for sure. So on top of all of that, she would also constantly make fun of his size, because by 14 years old, Ed stood 6 feet 4 inches tall.
Wow, 14?
14, yes.
Jeez.
She would refer to him as a quote-unquote real weirdo and tell him that no woman would ever want him. She also refused to coddle Ed. She denied him any affection, fearing that he would turn gay.
Wow.
That's so you're not going to love on your baby because you're scared he's going to turn gay. What kind of... That's first of all, where's the logic? Where is the logic?
Yeah. There isn't. There's not logic.
You're a female parent.
Yeah.
In later interviews, Ed referred to his mother as a sick, angry woman. It has been speculated that Clarnell suffered from borderline personality disorder, aka BPD. BPD is characterized as a mental disorder in which the party has unstable moods, behaviors, and relationships. Symptoms often include emotional instability, feelings of worthlessness, insecurity, impulsivity, and impaired social relationships.
Yeah.
In the fall of 1963, when Ed was 14, he ran away from home. He boarded a bus and went down to Van Nuys, California. I'm saying that wrong. Okay, cool.
No, you're fine.
I was like, I know I'm going to say that wrong.
It's a weird, It's a weird spelling. Van Nuys.
Van Nuys. I think I've heard of that, but I've never seen it spelt out.
Yeah.
Which was where his father was currently living. When he arrived there, he found out that his father had already remarried and had another son named David.
Oh, wow.
So he didn't even know that.
That's sad.
Is wild to me, which I get, like, the, you know, means of communication, you know, weren't the best probably back in those days, but that's your child and he doesn't know that you're remarried?
Yeah, that's sad.
So David, his half-brother, actually keeps his real name out of all media and the public eye due to privacy and safety concerns, which...
Oh, wow. Totally understand that.
And he also had a stepbrother, but there was literally, like, nothing about him. Okay. And I don't even know if he lived with them or not, but he was mentioned in some of the sources. His new stepmother, Elfrieda, was a beautiful German woman, and she unfortunately found Ed to be rather creepy. Ed spoke in later interviews how he found his stepmother attractive and would often stare at her and fantasize about her.
Okay.
Ed did end up living with his father, stepmother, and half-brother for a short time. However, his presence there made it difficult for his father to enjoy his new life.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And Christmas of that year, Edmund Jr. took Ed to live with his parents, Ed's paternal grandparents, Maud and Edmund Sr., which, as some of us may know, would be a horrible decision that he would soon regret.
Mm-hmm.
Being sent away by his father made Ed feel even more rejected. In an interview with his older sister, Susan, she spoke about how trying this time was for Ed. She said, quote, "He could have fun, he could laugh, he could play and be silly and visit and stuff like that, but deep down, he seemed awfully hurt. Like, you know, it really sunk in that his dad didn't want him, and this still intensified his love for his father. He just kept reaching and grabbing for him. So we took him fishing and all kinds of things, and then he went back down to California."
That's so sad. Like, I'd really feel bad for, like, the young him.
I know, me too. Once with his grandparents, Ed had a difficult time adjusting to life in rural North Fork, California. It's a tongue twister, too. His grandparents were pretty tough on Ed. He wasn't allowed to watch cartoons, read comics, be involved in social activities, or have friends over. They would tell him to go out and shoot gophers instead. Ed felt very isolated. He started to find himself projecting his hate for his mother onto his grandmother.
Oh, okay.
He accused her of emasculating his grandfather and himself, just as his mother did to Ed and his father. He did make one friend during his time with his grandparents, a young man named Mike Dozer. Mike actually lived basically on the same piece of property from the documentary I watched. Like, his house was right here, Ed's was right here, very close together, and they were also schoolmates, so they went to school together.
Okay.
Ed sort of protected Mike in a way, because Mike was the smallest kid in class, and Ed was the biggest.
Okay.
However, their friendship would not last long, due to the fact that Mike's mother, Elena, suspected that Ed had done something to their family cat, when the cat and one of her pillowcases suddenly went missing.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and we don't ever find out what happened to that cat or that pillowcase, but...
That's so sad. You can just guess.
Yeah, based on his history, we're just gonna assume that.
Yeah.
On August 27th, 1964, Ed got into a pretty heated argument with his grandmother. Afterwards, he went into his room, grabbed the .22 caliber rifle that his grandfather had given him. He walked back into the kitchen where his grandmother was sitting at the kitchen table, putting the finishing touches on her latest children's book, and he shot her in the head.
Oh my God.
He then shot her twice more in the back. His grandfather, who had been out grocery shopping that day, was starting to bring groceries inside. And Ed met him in the driveway and shot and killed him as well.
Jeez.
He was only 15.
15!
Yeah. After Ed killed his grandparents, he called his mother and confessed everything. Clarnell told him to immediately call the police and tell them what happened, which he did. Later, Ed would say that he shot his grandmother to, quote, see what it felt like. He also stated that he killed his grandfather so that he wouldn't have to find out that his wife had been murdered.
My God.
So, like, so twisted and so...
Yeah.
Ed was then handed over to the California Youth Authority, where he underwent a variety of tests, those of which determined he had a very high IQ. Psychiatrists also diagnosed Ed with paranoid schizophrenia. Paranoid schizophrenia is characterized by delusions of persecution, grandiosity, or jealousy, and by hallucinations, such as hearing voices, mainly of an auditory nature. After these tests and diagnoses, Ed was sent to Atascadero State Hospital, which is a maximum security facility for mentally ill criminals in San Luis Obispo, California. And at this mentally ill facility, it was like all adults. He was one of the few children that was there.
That can't be good for him.
And he was ginormous. So most of the other inmates, I guess you could call them, thought he was an adult, but he was actually just a 15-year-old boy.
Wow.
During his time at the state hospital, another set of psychiatrists performed their own collection of tests on Ed. They felt he was not at all paranoid schizophrenic, which I wouldn't think that either. He was instead diagnosed as having a personality trait disturbance with passive-aggressive type. And as I mentioned at the top of the episode, they tested him and his IQ was 145.
Right.
Ed was a model prisoner. He was a member of the JCs, which is the Junior Chamber of Commerce. He also worked inside the prison and was described as a very good worker, which is not typical of a sociopath. At first, Ed just sharpened pencils for the doctors, but soon he gained the confidence of the psychiatrists and social workers, and they allowed Ed to assist in giving psychiatric tests to other inmates.
Oh my gosh.
Wild. That is wild to me.
Wow.
Because of his age and because of the crimes that he committed. I don't know. That just seems...
Yeah, I just feel like patients should not be allowed to administer tests on other patients. Like,
yeah. Later, Ed revealed that he had figured out how the tests worked, which enabled him to manipulate the psychiatrist.
Of course.
He also stated that he learned a lot from the sex offenders that the tests were given to.
Oh, God.
For example, not to leave any witnesses behind, and how it was preferable to kill a woman after raping her to escape possible capture.
Oh my God.
So you have this teenage boy whose brain is still developing, who already has these sick urges, and this is what he's learning at a place that's supposed to be rehabilitating him.
Yeah, that's not good.
Yeah. Ed was known for being polite and cooperative. He always exhibited good manners and was always willing to help where he was needed. Ed knew he had to be on his best behavior and do everything just right if he had any chance of getting set free. Which is, like, pretty smart, you know, for a little teenage boy.
Yeah.
This all worked out in Ed's favor because on December 18th, 1969, which also happened to be Ed's 21st birthday, he was released from the state hospital. Okay. So this is just 6 years later for the murder of both of his grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
He was considered an honorable discharge, which meant that his records were officially sealed.
Oh, no. Okay.
Yeah, this is a big thing later on in the case, because I feel like if people knew this about him, he may not have gotten away with some of the odd things that arose, you know.
Yeah.
As far as the psychiatrists at the hospital were concerned, Ed was fully rehabilitated and would be an upstanding member of society. After his release, Ed was encouraged to go and stay with his mother till he was able to get on his feet again. But due to their toxic relationship, he was not feeling that. He was not on board with that idea. But ultimately, he decided to stay there temporarily because, in all honesty, he had nowhere else to go. He had no money. So,
yeah.
And his mother had remarried at this time. In the research that I did, I never once saw any kind of relationship between Ed and his stepfather. His name wasn't even really mentioned that much. So I don't know if they had already divorced at this time, but she was, you know, not the best woman to be with, from what I understand. So I think she kind of, you know, ultimately ended up divorcing him as well. When he was able to finally save up enough money, he did move out with a roommate. He also ended up meeting a young woman at a beach in Santa Cruz, and the two of them became engaged, but this did not end up lasting. So from what I understand, this girl was in high school. She was like 16 or 17 years old when they met, and then they got engaged, but she started to pick up on some of the odd behaviors, and so it ended up not working out. After Ed's release, he applied to become a state trooper, but he was denied due to his size, because at this time, Ed weighed around 300 pounds and was 6 feet 9 inches tall.
Jeez.
But I'm also like, what, like, unless he couldn't pass the tests and stuff, why would they deny him based on his size? So I would think they would want someone like that on their team, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting.
And not that this would necessarily sway him from the murderous acts that he would commit, but it definitely could have.
You don't know, yeah.
Yeah, it definitely could have. So he, you know, was denied becoming a state trooper, but he did end up making some friends in the Santa Cruz Police Department, and they referred to him as Big Ed. And he would often hang out with them at this place called The Juror, which is like a local watering hole, I guess you could say. It's like a dive bar. But he fraternized with a lot of the police force in Santa Cruz. Okay. According to biography.com, one officer actually gave him a training school badge and handcuffs, while another let him borrow a gun.
That's casual.
Just borrow a gun. That's real, yeah. In 1971, he got a job working for the California Department of Transportation. Later that same year, Ed was hit by a car while out riding his motorcycle.
Jeez, this guy is just like...
I know, he's just awful stuff. Awful all the way around. His arm was badly injured and he was unable to work, but luckily he did receive a $15,000 settlement in the civil suit that he filed against the car's driver. So he's got a lot of time on his hands, and he started turning his mind towards other pursuits. So he noticed a lot of young women, mostly college, you know, age students, had begun hitchhiking in the area. This was like big time for hitchhiking.
Yeah, prime time for hitchhiking.
Exactly. Ed had purchased a 1969 Ford Galaxy with some of his settlement money and began storing some tools he thought he might need to fulfill his murderous fantasies. Those tools included a knife, handcuffs, and a gun. According to Ed, he picked up over 100 hitchhikers before his sick urges got the best of him.
Oh, wow. So he was picking up hitchhikers and probably was planning to try to kill a lot of them, but then was like able to quote unquote control it.
Right. And in the documentary that I watched, so this is, you know, it's 1969, like the hippie movement is in full effect. The Summer of Love had just happened, like, what, a couple years before that?
Right.
Everyone's got long hair and, like, you know, wearing tie-dye and bell-bottoms and, you know, the whole nine. And this was, like, really uncomfortable for Ed because he was, like, really conservative. He was, you know, he thought these lazy hippies were just wasted space, and I don't know, he just it just probably fueled some of this stuff that, you know, happens because he was already having these urges, and then, you know, there's all these women hitchhiking and it's like easy access, and just the frustration of everyone just kind of whatever, doing what they were doing during those times. But like I said, he picked up over 100 hitchhikers before he let his urges get the best of him, because eventually his urges did get the best of him. Otherwise, we wouldn't be sitting here discussing him today.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that Ed was notably kind, polite, and helpful, at the end of the day, he was a sick, sadistic, necrophiliac serial killer. Possibly one of the most prolific serial killers of all time. And next time, we'll dive into the horrifyingly disgusting things that Edmund Kemper did to his victims.
Oh, okay.
And also, so, Mindhunter, have you seen it?
Yes.
Okay, so the guy who portrayed Edmund Kemper in Mindhunter is a mastermind. He was so good. He did it so well. Yeah. If you guys have not seen that show, first of all, go watch it because it's so good. But if you are interested in Edmund Kemper and like think that he's interesting and fascinating like I do, this guy did such a good job. And like the interviews in that were based on real interviews that he had. Right. And it is so creepy. It is so, so creepy. Because at one point, so later on, he does actually, you know, interview and he does his confession tapes, which are like a huge thing. And the police gave the psychiatrist a panic button. And one time, the guy that was interviewing him started to feel uncomfortable and pushed the panic button. And it didn't work. And they didn't come. And then Edmund said to them, or said to him, wouldn't it be funny or interesting or whatever if when they arrive, I just have your head sitting here on this table?
Oh my God. What?
And the guy's like pressing the button like.
And it's not working.
And it's not working. It took them 30 minutes to get back there. Oh, so after that, they changed the rules to where two people have to be in the room with the murderers at all times.
Right. Wow, that's so creepy. Oh my God.
I know. I just had to like include that, even though we'll get into more of that in the next episode. But
yeah.
Yeah. So that's part one of Edmund Kemper. The second part is going to be a good bit longer just because I am going to be covering all of the victims that unfortunately met their demise at the hands of Edmund Kemper. And I was thinking about just doing like a whole big giant episode, but I didn't know how long it was going to be. And, you know, gotta get you guys coming back for part two. So,
yeah. Yeah, part two will be good. You guys won't want to miss it. It'll be out this Thursday. So we're not going to make you wait long.
No. And we just want to thank you guys for listening as always. Don't forget to leave us a rating and review if you have not done so. I will be posting pictures as always on our Instagram and our Facebook. And I would love to hear what you guys think about this case on Facebook, which is probably the best place to really get into some conversations about it. But that's all I have for you guys today. And we will catch up with you with part two on Thursday. But until then, keep it human.
Bye.